which was secretive, which was underground.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was secretive and underground, it was very hierarchical, because you were always worried about information about what you were doing, getting back to the police and the military and so on were always watching and listening and so on. So security was a prime thing, and you just couldn't work any other way except. But to make a successful political party, what we thought, is that you needed a culture of discussion, you needed a culture of where you had that everybody's voice counted, everybody was mm-hmm. to be part of it, and mm-hmm. where you worked as much as you could by consensus.
Right.
And that cut across, and we didn't understand at the time, and in fact other people might say it wasn't that at all, but it cut across the whole chain of command idea of, you know, like, you get mm-hmm. your directions from the top and mm-hmm. tell them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ran into a continuing series of clashes with people in the leadership and found ourselves isolated and pushed out
mm-hmm.
because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly it came down to a question on was the problem with this country, the fundamental economic problem, was it because of the existence of the border, because of partition,
mm-hmm.
or was it because of an imperialist domination, mostly British imperialist, British American, was it imperialist domination, economic domination, of particularly the North, but also the South?
Right.
And once you came up against that, you were coming up against the thing of, well, in the traditional way of looking at it, the border was the problem. And we were saying, no, the border is a problem, but it's not the problem. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. not the fundamental problem. Mm-hmm. The fundamental problem is that your economy is basically controlled by people who are not subject to your government,
mm-hmm.
or who are not, you know, and the government was happy enough to do that. And especially you had a period of where you were actually government-wise trying to invite in multinational companies
mm-hmm.
to supply employment.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also at the expense of taking that you no longer had control of your own economy. You were at the mercy of what the multinationals wanted. So anyway, that ended up in us getting pushed out. And so we went off again, working more in an army direction.
Mm-hmm.
For that would be from about 1990 into the 2001.
Mm-hmm.
In 2001, I went, like, in what had happened in about 2000 was I was asked, would I take charge of a group who were there to to help those people as the peace process had started and there were prisoners being released. Those prisoners were obviously going to have a lot of difficulties. They had to find a place to live, they had to find a job, they had to, but more than anything else, they needed sort of moral support and help in settling back in. You know, so that when they were having difficulties, there was someone to turn to. When they were having, you know, and even when they weren't having difficulties, that they were with old comrades, old friends. So we had a place going not far from here, an office that they could come into at any time if they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they could get things like basic training on computers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing that, and arising out of that, then the thing about Colombia came up, and I went off to Colombia.
Right.
And of course, got arrested again.
Right.
So that was another 3 years.
Oh, I remember when that hit the newspapers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that was 3 and 10 and 3 again.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
We were lucky to get back out of Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
But we did, but again, Colombia exposed a fault line too, in that there always has been a good, with the ordinary people, a good gut internationalist thing in Irish republicanism.
Mm-hmm.
That it's also internationalist, it's not inward looking. And yet, there was this other thing that the Americans were involved in the peace process, and in recognition of the American claim that it was their backyard, a lot of Republicans were reluctant to take a stand on it. So, at first, they were saying they didn't know us. Mm-hmm. And then they came around saying, oh yeah, we know them all right, but we didn't know they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. But anyway, it came around that we had great support among the ordinary rank and file, and much less so from the higher up you went.
Right. Right.
And I had seen that at the time, and still see it as that they tend to be a bit timid about it. Instead of standing up and saying, yes, we have solidarity with groups all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we have every right to have solidarity with groups. The Brits don't apologize for having solidarity with the Israelis or mm-hmm. having solidarity mm-hmm. with any mm-hmm. right-wing regime mm-hmm. or anything. We don't have to apologize for mm-hmm. having solidarity with anybody. We just say, well, these people are fighting for their freedom. And we're in sympathy with them. Yeah. So like you did have like the Republican movement going to Cuba and so on,
right.
making solidarity there. So it's not that they were entirely not doing it, but they just weren't doing it as much as what I would have liked to see, and others would have liked to see them do it. So anyway, we arrive now at a situation where you know your peace process has been going. The first ceasefire was 1994. It broke down. It was the second ceasefire in 1996.
Right.
And the peace process, you could say, has been going continuously from 1996, and this is 2009, so you're 13 years. And you're still looking at it and saying, is this delivered? So what's happening, I think, and this is only a personal opinion, is that you're having the possibility that this is a strategy which you could call the Palestinian strategy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where the Palestinian Authority were told, yes, we can have a Palestinian state. You must keep with the negotiations. You must keep with it to get this Palestinian state. And they really wanted a Palestinian state. So, but they were never delivering. They were only given enough to keep them in the talks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never the substantial
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened after years and years of that, which I take as a strategy on behalf of the Israelis, but actually delivered by the Americans, State
mm-hmm.
Department,
mm-hmm.
was you had a widened division which led to the formation of Hamas, not the formation of Hamas, but to the coming to power of Hamas.
Right, right.
Because people had, as it were, become disenchanted with all the faults and all the things that were in the PLO and mm-hmm. the Palestinian Authority.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinian people now are deeply, deeply split, divided. And from an Israeli point of view, they don't need a peace process anymore. They don't even have to pretend anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They can go ahead with pushing the Palestinians out of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Because on a military front, they're divided and can't fight an effective military campaign. And on a political front, they're mm-hmm. divided and can't fight an effective peace strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are the British doing the same to us with, again, the American State Department as the actor, as the main manipulator
mm-hmm.
on a Sproger?
Mm-hmm.
Coming along. Are we putting the same? Now, that worry in different ways of expressing, and people are saying, the peace process isn't delivered. But what it's doing is it's leading to deeper and deeper divisions within the Republican community.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to fighting the British, why we had a very successful war in relative terms was that communities, by and large, were very solidly united against the British. And the British couldn't undermine the fighting spirit of communities. They could capture or kill guerrilla units, but other units would spring up again. But if they could divide and fracture the community, they could maintain their control for another generation. We are seeing the evolution of a Palestinian strategy in Ireland. Or some people say, I know you just haven't enough patience, it takes a long time for the peace strategy to work. But you can see the dilemma. Now, this attack on that killed a couple of British soldiers, that could have happened 3 months ago, could have happened 6 months ago, or it mightn't have happened for another 3 months. But it was going to happen sometime.
Right.
Because the situation has been created by the promise of progress to keep people in a peace process, but the failure to deliver. And the failure to deliver, is it that it's politically too difficult, or is it part of a strategy? And that's what the dilemma is now. And it is, even at this stage, not easy to convince people that who's in charge of this strategy. There's a lot of Republicans who would like to think, well, the Republicans are making the run in here. But the British are, like, the 500-600 years experience as a colonial power, and know well how to manipulate, and know well how to think in the long term. And to them, a 15-year strategy is not, you know, it's not new, it's not, it's not novel. Right. They're always on 15-year strategies or 20-year strategies or generational strategies. So that's where we arrive at today. Sorry it went on so long.
But it also has to be seen within the context of the economic recession and the huge problems that are confronting capitalism. And a lot of people who would be maybe sympathetic to the point that Jim is very accurately making, it seems to me a lot of people will think, well, the Republican movement as such, or Sinn Féin as it passes for now, doesn't have anything to say about the current situation and the huge crisis of which capitalism is facing in the world. And that's another great difficulty, which I think is there for everyone who is a Republican from the earlier times.
I think maybe just second in one and then I leave you to it. In the past, when the whole country was a colonial possession of the British, most Irish nationalists thought in terms that all our economic difficulties is due to British control. That the British discriminated against the woolen industry, they discriminated against the different industries that were set up for their own advantage, which was true. But they thought that the extension of that argument was that if you got the British to go, you had solved your economic problems, because a native Irish government would run the country in the interests of the Irish people. But even back at the time of Connolly in 1916, Connolly was pointing out that that wasn't so, that capitalism was not confined to any particular nation, and thought very little of national boundaries, and worked, you know, like on a, it was a supranational sort of institution. But still the lingering idea always in the back of Irish minds was our economic problems are due to foreign occupation. Foreign occupation just meaning control.
Controlled
by foreigners in the interest of foreigners. And of course, getting a parliament in Dublin didn't solve the problems, and that left a lot of people confused and disorientated as to, you know, the value of freedom.
Yeah, but that makes sense, because I mean I do stay up on the situation with occupied Palestine, and I know that there's at least 10-15 years ago, if not 20, people were dissatisfied with the role of Arafat. You know, and which is a part of the thing where I'm saying, like, it just seemed like when it came to the 70s, by the end of the 70s, a lot of our movements was facing something different, you know, and our movements was, like, really suffering all around. in the United States, it's like we never got to the points where you got here. They destroyed our movements. You know, our movements that came out of the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, was a much more nationalist and saw ourselves on the same level of liberation struggle as here in Africa, Asia, and other liberation struggles. Like, we wanted self-determination, however that might look in the United States. We know that we're dispersed through the United States where, you know, we're not exactly the same, but in so many ways we are just a domestic colony, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's like the United States did similar things in terms of it propped up those leaders who were real pro-American, who were not really fighting in the interest of the majority of Black people. The whole civil rights, you know, when it got to just civil rights, then you had Malcolm X who was saying it's beyond civil rights. Like, at least to try to get us to think like we just can't fight within the legitimacy of the United States. You know, we got to really continue to look at that they kidnapped and brought us here, and we have been on the bottom from day one. We have got to fight for complete self-determination. I don't know if we quite knew how that would look, yeah. But it's going to be figured out one way or another. But it's like when we started seeing what was happening with the Palestinians, we started seeing the difficulties here. You started seeing like African liberation struggles, allegedly victorious, but still controlled by either their old colonial powers or the United States, the emergence of the United States. It's like all of them turned sour, you know, and like people right back in the same situation, you know. So like for us, I think it was good. The Panthers, I mean, we were not just like an anti-racist movement. We had a class analysis too. We didn't want a capitalist society. We was talking about not just how the United States treats us, but how that system treats people in the world. So how can that work out at the same time that we're not going to create a system that is going to be uncritical towards capitalism? You know, because some Black nationalist groups were definitely uncritical, yeah. You know. I just often wonder, like, if we had sustained ourselves, if we hadn't been crushed by the mid-70s, would we have been in a similar situation of here, Palestine, or some of them other ones? And I think a part of even Obama's thing is that we lost. They set up Black communities, which became predominant in some of the major cities, as like neo-colonial governments. We were now being elected to mayors of major cities, but carrying out the same policies, police force occupying our communities in the same ways. We still get discriminated and all that stuff, but now you see more Black faces in positions of power, you know, keeping us under control. You know, and the same with the media and stuff like that. They were real slick in the sense that they would put Black faces in real prominent positions to make it seem like we're having all this progress, but to most of us is still right on the bottom. And you would see not the Native Americans at all. Yeah. They're still on the reservations.
Yeah.
You know? So I often wonder, like, if we had been able to keep going, would we have been able to avoid this? You know? And now, on some levels, I think, no, maybe. We probably would have had some of the similar problems.
Could there be an element that you kind of misidentified the thing in that? Quite rightly, because of all the religion, or not religion, all the discrimination and the sort of the Ku Klux Klan and all that. They were discriminating against you because you were Black. Whereas in fact they may have moved on to the fact that they were discriminating against people because they were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they were Black as well give a thing that they don't really have a problem, I think.
Mm-hmm.
With putting Black people into positions of power, because here they don't have a problem. The British actually would like to have the involvement of both, you know, like in the North, come to Catholics and Protestants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That they would like to have, they would like to be able to say, look, there isn't religious discrimination here.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fair. That would suit them very well, because what they are concerned with is it's political allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could turn over and become a loyal subject, they would welcome that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the case maybe in the States it's quite similar, that maybe they don't care what colour you are, as long as you support the system.
Mm-hmm.
That would that be?
I think that I think the allegiance part began to become important maybe after the 60s, but the fact of the matter is that it's like even with 9/11, it's like, I think before 9/11, they could just count on us not being a factor, or they know that we're going to come and support whatever the United States say, what we're supposed to be fighting. 9/11 is just like, for the first time for me, it just seemed like black people was just automatically on their own. You didn't even have to push us. We're supporting the United States, you know. But, so I mean, like, we're part of the all that to get our allegiance now, but the fact of the matter is, economically and every other way, we're still on the bottom, you know. So it's like even what they're trying to push the thing now, like Obama represents this post-racial society, when the United States is nowhere at a post-racial society. It's like all those folks on the bottom, for the most part, are still predominantly people of color and poor whites. You know, in the prisons, it's predominantly people of color. And the core of that is black folks and Native Americans. And even when you deal with the prison, it's like the majority of the black prisoners, you trace their ancestries, in terms of the United States history, back to the southern plantations, you know. And so all of the same dynamics is there, you know. And it makes it difficult in this sense that you still got workers, you know, the more revolutionary-minded workers who still push a thing about, it's almost like the IWW, you know, all of us are workers, we should all come together. Yeah. But the racial dynamics keeps cutting right in there, because even white workers don't want to recognize that some of their privileges come from those of us of color on the bottom. It's like it's so into the American system that it cannot be ignored, you know. Yeah. And it's why, you know, like the Native Americans still got to fight for sovereignty, you know. And people still want to look at black people like, oh, well, we're Americans, but we're not treated like Americans, only in times of difficulty. You know, so for me, it's like I still consider myself in a liberation struggle, because the contradictions began 400, 500 years ago, you know. And if you're not dealing with that, then you're not being real, because the same place that we were in the beginning is essentially the same place we are now, you know. So Obama gets up and says to Reverend Jeremiah Wright that he's just stuck in the past, that he doesn't want to come up. No, Jeremiah Wright is correct. You can't ignore the foundations of this country.
Yeah.
You know, anything else is being, either you're lying or you're just being very naive. You know, but the United States is very, very good in even convincing us that we're all Americans, and we just, even black people, like they convince us that we just got to work harder. You know, not that there's systemic structures or practices that prevent you, but you know, we just got to work hard. And Obama pretty much says the same thing. He is who he is because of hard work, you know.
Yeah. And in fact, in a way, that people could use Obama and say, look, a black man can make it to the very top.
If he's clever.
And that's the message now.
Yeah.
That's the message, you know. But it's like self-determination. Self-determination is still, like, it is so key. We must control the institutions and the economy in our communities. That's why I like what the Zapatistas is doing, because they're saying that the lands that they're on now, they're going to fight for them to be able to create their own world. If that should change the dynamics of Mexican capitalism and their client relationship to the United States, hey, it's not on them. They're fighting for the right to live free lives. And I just feel the same way with this. I think it was more so in the 60s and the 70s because many of the major cities were becoming increasingly black. And the major cities being increasingly industrial, the center of communications, finances and stuff, we were like in such a position that if we had continued with these revolutionary movements, like with the workers in Detroit, auto factories, you know, and other places in the South, we could have been in a position to radically change, or at least in that, using that word vanguard a lot of revolutionary changes in the very foundations of U.S. society. But they quickly used strategy to just prevent that. I mean, deindustrialization happened quickly. Detroit is nothing like Detroit of the 60s, you know, and a lot of the cities where we're still big numbers, they have divided us by using political voting lines and banks using residential tactics to keep us divided, that we're falling subject to it. So it's a different kind of like colonial struggle, you know, I mean, whatever we want to call it, post-colonial, whatever, but we're in a situation where our backs are still against the wall.
And how does this recession, I know it's very early and we haven't come to terms.
Hold on, let me just ask something else. You said when right at the very beginning that there were a lot of people, a lot of guys out there that are well able to know how to take things forward amongst the black communities. And I just wanted to ask you, what way do they know how to take it forward?
I think the Panthers, I think we had some ideas. And I think it was groups like the Panthers, groups like the League of Revolutionary Black Workers out of Detroit, some of your other groups, Republican New Africa. You had a bunch of groups, and there was times where there was these conferences where we come together and try to kind of figure out common visions, which never really worked because it was the divisions was too much. But when you looked at people's knowledge of the situation, their analysis, and I mean, at the time, you know, Marxism-Leninism was pretty popular, but people were applying it really to the United States and not just copying it from whatever Russia and other people were saying. But there was a lot of people who had some idea of how this country could change. Great James and Grace Lee Boggs out of Detroit, you know, but it's like we could never pull it together. Because from the infiltration to the egos or just to the lack of experience, the things would just fall apart, you know. And I mean, I think that we did, even as Panthers, I think we did a good job, but we were young. We couldn't quite get it. And our intergenerational connections was really bad because we pretty much told the older generation, y'all just didn't do, leave us alone, we're moving forward, you know. And then the FBI and all like that. I think once we kind of caught them off guard, they got it back together right quickly and realized that this is just kid stuff. Within a 2-year period, our organization was falling apart, you know. And after that, I mean, I just think that was an accumulation of defeat after defeat after defeat, generation after generation. People are like, now, what's the sense of fighting back? They always going to defeat us. And it was like you were saying at that point, maybe in the 70s, was like in the North.
Late
60s. Like, people like, for what? But that's Harlem right now.
And the IRA embodied the fact that it was possible.
Yeah.
To beat them. I mean, this huge outcome of the IRA struggle. And, I mean, that has empowered people in the North. But maybe not to fight to engage in a political struggle for their rights.
Yeah.
Do you know, I mean, there's no taking away the impact of the IRA struggle on the people in the North. Unfortunately, not amongst the people in the South. I mean, the nearest that they would have come to that was around something like the Concerned Parents, where the people thought at that time that Sinn Féin were gods down here, because they saw them in some way, something which was encouraged by the Sinn Féin themselves, you know, we're the people's army and we're going to be working down here to get rid of drugs, which was crazy thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a huge number of mistakes on the way, mm-hmm. and were very hierarchical in their way of approach to what was really a community struggle coming out of the communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't benefit from that at all in terms of organisational structures in the South. And I mean, that thinking still remains a bit in the South. You know, that Sinn Féin, they were when they were running around against the druggies, those were really good times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a chance of changing things down here. But I mean, it was never taken forward in a more ideological or building an ideological base, which essentially, it always taught me that the Black Panthers, at least in the early days, they had, as you said, they had a class analysis, and Sinn Féin has never really managed to come to an agreed position on a class analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's been the huge weakness that really has dogged Sinn Féin, and means that we're in the situation in which Jim talked about, the contradiction about whether the Brits are really trying to withdraw or whether they're really just found a new way to hold on to mm-hmm. the North and the mm-hmm. people in the North.
And the divisions that even I see coming out of this strategy that you're talking about, the Palestine strategy,
yeah.
is like really is creating all these divisions.
Yes.
And people are like tired. It makes me think of like with the Nicaraguan Revolution. Yeah. It's just like at a certain point the people were like tired.
Yes, they just
and they just kind of gave up.
Yeah. The contra strategy was a killer.
And here's the United States again playing
the
part.
The contra strategy was being applied in Colombia
mm-hmm.
at the time
when you were.
When I was there. Like, right. I could see. In fact, it was Rosa that sent me the thing in the first place and said this is a contra strategy. But then you could see it. What they'd done in Nicaragua, they were doing again in Colombia. And the other thing about Colombia is the huge Israeli involvement. That the counter-strategy, the counter-revolution was the American military trainers on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They did 600, and this is in Colombia. But the biggest supplier of military equipment outside of the Americans was the British.
Mm-hmm.
But the British would never say what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, you were always left, well, it's not guns and it's not planes, it's not that. The only thing it could be was surveillance and intelligence equipment mm-hmm. and training.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a constant flow of Colombian generals over to England and into mm-hmm. the six counties.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one on it was is that the Colombian military are equipped like the rifles, the carrier galley rifles, mm-hmm. the Uzi submachine guns, the artillery, the mortars, all that, all Israeli made.
Mm-hmm.
You find a big Israeli footprint. And what you have is that combination all over the world, Israelis, British, but Americans is the main leading. And I think that the Germans and French would like to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. At the minute, it's those three countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that while they're talking about international terrorism, what you have is de facto an international, I don't know what you would call it, it certainly isn't it's counterinsurgency,
mm-hmm.
counter-liberation movement.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a thing which seems to be based on quite long terms, not just military, but with a big element of economic and propaganda, you know, like control of media.
Right.
So, and the other thing that was very noticeable in Colombia to me
mm-hmm.
was the huge push to reinsert or to insert the English language in place of Spanish
mm-hmm.
in all the key institutions. Mm-hmm. Like in the army and in the police, mm-hmm. they were pushing English like mad.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all sorts of English. And I was saying, why do you want to speak English? What, you know, what's the big thing about it? Oh, you won't get promotion, you must have English.
Mm-hmm.
You must have English to get ahead. A funny thing like there is that the army and the police would talk to you about these things. In fact, I remember once like a quite senior policeman coming in and talking to us as if we were and saying about that, you know, his belief was that the police should be neutral in the war, that mm-hmm. police should be serving the communities,
mm-hmm.
and the military should look after fighting the guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas to us, police were always the front line in fighting guerrillas,
because mm-hmm.
they were the intelligence gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
anyway, that's getting maybe taken. You know, you haven't contributed. You could put a different perspective.
Yes.
And it would help to broaden out what we're saying, because we're coming from, as it were, more or less the same point. Me and Rose have been together for 15 years, so our views are fairly well.
I find all this really interesting. I suppose, I don't know, maybe an interesting thing I could say is, when I grew up in Ireland, I was born in 1981,
yeah.
I became politically aware around the time the second ceasefire.
Yeah.
So, the war in the north, well, I was very much aware of it growing up, but it was definitely winding down.
Yeah.
And just like two things I thought about is like what Rose talked about, the level of politics in the north. Like I remember growing up where, particularly when I became political, where you know, you go home and all the boys would be singing all the rap songs,
yeah.
Get up the next day, try to talk politics, just go, I'll keep that shit away from you. You know, so it's this bizarre, and I don't know what created that down here, was it a lack of that politics was never really escalated, and the struggle down here was never really escalated on the level it was up there. But I suppose like my take on all this is from a very different,
even different generation.
Like, you know, the war, like a lot of the war in the north, like, yeah. When I got involved in politics first, I absolutely hated it. Until,
yeah.
Nothing to do with me. Like, and then it was like, mainly when I was involved in the Shell to Sea stuff, I met Republicans, and then when I joined the WSM,
yeah.
There was people in that who had come through the Republican movement who kind of went, look, you can't just wipe out a struggle that went on in this country. You've actually, and have you talked about this, that, and the other, and would have become more interested in it. I think now, though, one thing, what I find looking at it, you know, when you talk about the way maybe it was easy when you had people like Thatcher, or you've got like, I'm trying to think of someone in the US, but you know, there's like figurehead racists. Or like Ian Paisley.
Like Reagan
people like that.
Together, yeah.
Like, whereas now I think it's moving towards a far more complicated, and from their point of view, sensible, that you get people like Obama, or even like Bertie in this country,
yeah.
Bertie, the previous Prime Minister here, had this thing of being like the man of the people, and at the same time, the guy is undoubtedly ripped off his country, signed off all our natural resources, and they. I suppose it's like what you get here, maybe more than in other countries, yeah. Is a level of imperialism that's like probably so far developed that like that's where you get people going, oh, well, things aren't that bad, you know.
Yeah.
We don't see it here because what we see probably here is something that's so far down the line that they've achieved a lot of the stuff you're talking about. But I don't know, I think it's probably more interesting for you to keep on your conversation, because I think I can't answer another question. I don't have any opinions on it. I'm just finding this very, the reasons why it all went in that period of what Shanti's identified, that period in the 70s, as to why it all suddenly went that way. The only question that I always wonder about these things is, coming back from my point of view as being an anarchist, being very aware, we're never on our own. We're going to a massive crisis at the moment.
Yeah.
This country's going to change massively. We are not going to shape that. We're just not big enough. Our ideas and our currency doesn't mean we can't have an impact, but it's about there's going to have to be left-wing groups coming together that are going to have to figure out, going, you have that opinion now on that issue, I have a different opinion. Can we, like, what is the nature of the future of left unity? Because, like, sometimes the question, even the entire left in Ireland unified, is it even up to the task? I'm pretty certain that any of us alone will not do it, because we just don't have the strength, but possibly together we may be able to spark it in a way, you know, some of that stuff. But again, I'd say
I appreciate that. I mean, even the other day, because I visited Cork, Galway, and Belfast, and the Workers' Solidarity Movement has arranged it for me. My understanding of like worker struggles and stuff like that is very much informed by like anarchist readings, right?
Yeah.
But my mind always goes to the ideal situation. Well, I kept thinking after the thing with the two soldiers getting killed, like people don't want certain things to get out of hand. So what would happen if we could organize like in the workplace like it's always been talked about? where those same workers belong to communities, and those people in the communities are the ones who join organizations above ground, underground, that so that they could have an impact in directing the level of the extra-legal struggles, you know, to keep them under some kind of control or keep some balance there, you know. And I because I think a lot of times it's people not getting involved that makes others feel like something has to be done, because the leadership who's on it now is just taking, they feel, is taking it on a certain road that's disastrous, and somebody's got to get up and do something. You know, I mean, like, you ain't had but a few groups like that in the United States. I just think we never got that far. But that's why I really didn't, like, with this latest, two soldiers got killed, and when allegedly it's the real IRA, which me being here, is just I found out that there's all these other different groups, right? But it's like somebody somewhere feels like something needs to be done. Like you said, it could have happened 3 months ago, 6 months ago. Yeah. You know somebody is going to do something.
Yeah.
But I'd be so concerned that if there were more community struggles, and struggles connected to people who work, wherever you work, like we have got to figure out some way to incorporate these things, because somehow those folks who do the extra legal stuff, it can possibly be kind of kept in check. You know, I mean, it might just be idealistic, but it's like, it's the same people from our community somewhere. They ain't coming from no universities and stuff. Somebody's frustrated somewhere, you know, but some people's frustration can also make a process real difficult, or maybe destroy some of the potential good stuff in certain processes. And how do you kind of, you know, play with that?
That's the big problem now.
Yeah.
What Rose pointed out there, and you were saying too, we're going into a period now of, I would imagine, huge, not just economic change, but probably social and political upheaval as well. And we're kind of almost too small to influence it. And what's happening in the Republican movement, with this, what I was talking about, yeah, is only one aspect of a big, big picture,
right,
of which the social struggles, like what is happening now, you have a bus strike outcome, you have the police out today on that protest, you have a whole series of protest things growing, particularly fueled by the injustice that people perceive in the way they're saying, all right, we're into an economic crisis, and to some extent it's international, but there's a big extent to which it was caused by the misbehavior of the very well off.
Mm-hmm.
But now the measures they're putting into place,
mm-hmm,
financial measures,
mm-hmm,
are really falling on the shoulders of the ordinary people,
mm-hmm,
and not on the
mm-hmm,
the big number of, mm-hmm, so that's for work.
They haven't even addressed the fact that they can't revert to the old ways, which is what they're looking to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was saying earlier about them using the recession. Everyone, we're going to share this pain to, in fact, drive that onto the working class. I mean, there's no question about it. And I mean, you have, which is a really unheard of in Ireland. We're going to get a day of general strike by all the workers, at least in the south. I don't think there's been any effort by the Republicans that I've heard to try and incorporate that into the six counties. I mean, it is huge times.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hey,
Joe Canadian
went
after you. Is he coming up? Is he gone?
But we were just talking there about, you know, like that we're going into a whole series of strikes and a whole series of things, and kind of in a way putting where the Republicans stand in the middle of all that. Would you have any
about the economy, like?
Yeah, well, just in general, what's happening now as a result of the whole, you could say, the recession.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean,
I think we'll have to be very careful how we work this. You know, in the economy at the moment, I mean, we have to, in a lot of things, we're going to have to back the government and save the money. But having said that, whenever we get on our feet again, we have to make sure that the country is completely different in the way it's run. You know, then we make our mark. But we have to be very pragmatic in the way we approach this whole thing. Yeah,
when you say back, then what do you mean? A sort of a government and national unity? Or
well, I would have thought. I thought we should have called for that. But
what would that have entailed? A government and national unity?
Well, I suppose it would be a committee set up on the stance on the representation.
I think that's falling. A hook, line, and sinker for their shite. I think that's falling hook, line, and sinker for their shite. The shite of the government.
Falling for it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just carrying along with it. We need to put up a flag very, very clearly. And I think the problem is that Sinn Féin never has really seen where that flag needs to be hoisted. And I don't mean, I'm not talking geography, I'm talking in terms of what you would have referred to as class analysis. I mean, it seems to me it's the lack of class analysis within Sinn Féin as a movement. That has bedeviled this struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it, precisely, most Republicans would probably come out with precisely what you just said.
What?
And that's very understandable. But I mean, that was what held us back in Tyrus Jack, which you were involved in, minimally.
In what way?
Because there's currently no leadership for the crisis. For the opposition to the fight back, if you want to call it that.
Of course, I agree with that. Absolutely.
And we're not hoisting that flag. And yet, I mean, Sinn Féin distinguished itself in the recent campaign last summer where we beat the Lisbon Treaty, and that was very important in the European and the global context.
Mm-hmm.
That we put a stop to that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have another vote asking people to vote on the same thing, exactly mm-hmm. the same thing again,
mm-hmm.
in the expectation that we're in a crisis and we need the EU and everyone will now vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that was a huge opportunity for
Sinn Féin,
which we haven't been able to take forward.
Right.
Garda is not where the political organisations are involved in this country in the next 6 months. I think there will be violent demonstrations. And it doesn't necessarily, it might even be because a political organisation calls it, because if people start going hungry, people then don't give a fuck about who, if a government, if a policeman, if anyone is stopping them, if you will get food. And I think the question is where political organisations stand in that then, because people, because I think it happens time and time again in history, is that if that goes on, and a political movement, organisation, whatever it is, doesn't engage itself, it just gets swept away.
Yeah.
And the same way as I think there's a possibility that a lot of the power structures and stuff like that, now I'm not saying it's going in a positive direction, it can go and, like, what could come out of this could be, like, you worry about people like Leo Varadkar and people like that that could do this thing of throwing themselves up as some sort of authoritarian right wing. But I think it will be, and thought about it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's down to the organisation. I think people are going to fight this because they're going to have to. And I have no idea where that whole trajectory is going. And I think, I just think it's a very, it's a big stark out there. And who knows what way it could go, and when there's violence, the violence may not happen in the way that political organisations would like it. You know, trade union struggles, it could be, I don't know.
Scary. People are scared.
But I think that will inevitably end at some confrontation.
Yeah, everyone a coffee. Coffee then.
Sure. But we can't be a party that rolls with sales with every cutback. We don't agree no to this and no to that. And we have to have ideas on how we get out of this hole. And then we can say, of course we can say that was years of mismanagement, corrupt governance from the beginning of the foundation of the state. We all know that and we have rehearsed all that, but we have to have ideas how we're going to get out of this.
So good ideas. Done, but you need a policy.
Well, economics.
Say, if you were in charge, what would you do?
Well, first of all, you wouldn't bail out the banks. And it's completely crazy that we've got ourselves into going along with that. I mean, that's a given of the government present contemplation of the question, how do they deal with the deficit?
But the government will say that they didn't spend one penny in bailing out the banks. They haven't spent a penny yet.
Not yet, but that's because...
Should they not nationalise the banks?
Sorry? Why would they nationalise the banks? That's exactly what they're talking about. It's the same thing.
What happens if the banking system collapses?
Well, it's a deal. We only need one bank anyway. What do you want all these other banks?
But I'm not worried. I'm only asking you a question.
Well, that's my answer to it. Let them go. Let them suffer the cost of what they brought on themselves.
So then you'll have the...
And what, everyone else.
Well, you'll have that... what do you call them? Competition of the country there.
AMF.
Is that...
If you read the article yesterday in the Business Post... there's $300 billion worth of deposits sitting in this country, and most of them haven't gone yet. I mean, we just mobilise those resources through one central bank, which is not allowed to lend and starve the people of money. I mean, it's completely crazy, the crisis, that the manifestation of the crisis in this country. Absolutely crazy. And I'm not saying the original decision that Sinn Féin took, which was to guarantee the deposits of ordinary people, was wrong. I think that they should have taken that was ground, but then they should have begun to think, what the hell is going on here? The cutbacks are completely unnecessary.
There's no economic
standing.
That's what I'm saying, that they should embrace the strategies I'm just saying.
We talk about having no media, but we all complain about no media. We had the media for a weekend there.
Yeah.
We had the complete media for the weekend. We'd be better without the media with some of the crap that would come out.
All we talked about was the corruption of the bankers. That's part of the truth.
Tax the bad guys. It's staffed.
But the thing is...
The fundamental of that in relation to the conversation we're having here is fundamentally that Sinn Féin has always been weak on the ideology side. I mean, when you said you referred to maybe meeting a few Republicans and they just didn't want to discuss politics, they never wanted to discuss politics. I mean, my effort within Taoiseach, and Jim's the same beforehand, was to introduce discussion within ex-Republican prisoners, within that circle. And it was to try and drive forward an ideology which at least was going to challenge all the strategies that Western imperialism is using. In the form of the Brits in our country. And I mean, we repudiated that. I mean, I didn't succeed, despite the fact that you were on the board of management and all the rest, and there were other very good people on the board of management. I mean, you had no interest in driving that forward, and we failed.
But anyway, we're going back to...
No, I'm just going back to the ideological weaknesses of Sinn Féin.
But the thing is that you brought up a very good point. That is that if you're going out in front of the people, general people, they've heard and they know how the situation came about. What they really want to know is, are you capable of leading them out of it? And I think that what we have to say, but in my bit, is taken from Brit history. When they came out of the Second World War, they were able, on the basis that during their wartime cabinet, their wartime government, they had sort of promised the people, as they said, they promised the soldiers a land fit for heroes to live in. Okay. Now, after the war, what they'd done was they set up, they elected a socialist government, they set up the health service now, which was really a good, in terms of human development, although it was the Brits and we don't like the Brits and all, it was a good thing. And they set up the education system, which was another thing that we... I have to look at and say, God, I pity we couldn't do that. So what we have to say is you turn around to the people and say, look, we're in a crisis. It's similar to a war. We will, as it were, share the blame. But first of all, it has to be fair in its share. And second of all, the end result will be a country that we can be proud to live in. And that is a country that will institute all these changes.
Straight after the last World War, I mean, the British Army, I remember the British Army camped in front of our house.
And Churchill was a bastard and so on.
No,
there was
a huge movement amongst the working people to say, we're not coming back to this isn't a land for heroes, no question.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't see that that really impacts on it. I mean, the challenge has to be, what worries me is in relation to what
Chris has done.
What Finn referred to, that you expect trouble on the streets and violent marches and so on. I mean, the spirit that has been inculcated by the Brits and the Catholic Church in this country is that property lies down. And it's going to be very, very hard to expect that to take off in the South. And there is no tradition, well, that's not true, but there doesn't appear to be a tradition in recent years of violent protests. So, I mean, I think you may be right.
People weren't hungry.
Exactly. Yeah.
People weren't hungry.
But I don't think that when I say there's going to be violent protests, I don't think it's going to be that, like, people will go, I want, like, this country's very, very obviously not at it. It's not going to be raise a banner of socialism or a fight for it. It's going to be the country, like, there's a possibility that the country will go bankrupt. Like, that now is not a... It's not a fairy tale thing. When that happens,
they're looking at that we could be like gracious now, we could be like that next year.
Like if there's no money coming in, you know, for people on the dole, okay, the first day I can survive, I don't have any dependents, I'll find something to eat. But like, there's people who could have 2-3 kids.
Yeah,
and when those kids start going hungry, they're looking at them.
Yeah.
They're not, I don't think it's down to, I think people can move very quickly at that point and go, Lidl is full of food, they're going to try and charge me X, Y, and Z. I don't really care if it's a law against theft or whatever. I'm not going to let this person starve. And I think, I'm not saying it's going to be, I think what we're going into is just so, if you just kind of, what I'm basing it on is just like, there's this here, and there's no money, and there's food. And I think people very quickly start going, I have to feed myself, or, I'm just on the earth. I think we're going to have to rethink the whole way everything has gone. I think capitalism and the global structure is broken. It's so deep. I don't know if they'll ever get back to where they were. But I think everything, for the solution to this, everything has to come back up for negotiation about how people get involved in politics. Whether it is, you tell people, no, look, you've got to sit down yourself and think about this, as opposed to, I think you have to present ideas. At the same time, it's going, well, do you want to put a shape on that idea? What's your opinion on it? Because... Yeah.
Because if you say to the ordinary person, you know, you have to come up with a way of getting out of this economic crisis, the ordinary person would say, look, I haven't a clue. But if you were able to say, well, look, there are a few alternatives here, you know, throw them out, and this and the other crowd are throwing out their alternatives. So what you have to do is argue for years and try and get people to follow.
We're not even at the ball game to start.
But we'd have to be talking about something radical, something different. I mean, why couldn't we call, even in our set, in this present state that we're in now, call for a cut in wages of over 100,000? Nobody should be earning over 100,000 in this day and age in the state this country's in. Something mad like that. Why should anybody earn any more than that when people at the bottom end of the scale is struggling to survive?
In the United States, we're going through our that crisis. All the activists and everybody, I think it's one reason I never really stayed up on, every time there's a crisis, especially the Marxist groups, would be like, this is it. Capitalism in crisis is going to fall.
Yeah.
And following from that is supposed to be, people are just going to have this consciousness because they're going to be so fed up that the revolution is going to happen. You know? And I'm like, man, it just don't happen like that. One is because the capitalists are really good at making the poor people feel like they have to take this stuff and suck it up. You know, Katrina, that Hurricane Katrina just was like, all of us in the black movement felt like, this is it. If anything's going to teach the black folks that we got to organize and all the white Americans that racism is still entrenched, it's going to be Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
Hurricane Katrina did not do that.
It didn't change
it. It did not change anything. Except it made them real estate people who wanted that land anyhow. It gave them an excellent opportunity to get it. Now, so they just cleared out all these people. So like even here, I mean, there may be people in the streets, but they just concerned with their economic interests, their day-to-day interests. They're just angry because they may not be able to pay their bills. But I mean, who's going to be out there to convince them that that's not even it? Look at who does this. Do we want to keep giving power to these people that create the situation? Why can't we take that power and create that world from the bottom? You know, and that's what I don't hear people like in the United States talk about. You know, because I felt like in the 60s when the Black Power movement, you had folks that was just, I mean, we just demanded total control. And some people just going up to the school system and just like, that's it, we're taking it over. That's the attitude is just not there anymore. It's somebody up somewhere in some position of power, we just got to get to them and they're going to make it all right. You know, and that's the danger of Obama. You know, it's just like he's all these people that he's appointed to office or this new mood in the country. Somehow this crisis is going to be taken care of and America is going to be still going to be great.
Just ask Ashanti this one. I'm sorry, it's a quick question. Remember that. Just,
you
want to sit here? No, I didn't. I know, I'm going on about the US, but like, say that things like the Rodney King, the NRA, stuff like that. I think a bit of what potentially could see things is happening is where he perceived something. And I don't think it was a huge political organization or anything. That was just where people went, no, not anymore. And I'm not saying that's necessarily things here won't go the same way, that it'll just peter out. But I do think, was there any kind of, do you know any in the background, like what, or was that just that thing of going, right, that's it, no more?
People was upset all over, even though the main rebellions and stuff happened in L.A., but people was upset all over. I remember even in New York, there was some march through the downtown area because of the verdict that cleared all the cops.
Yeah.
But it's like, it goes right into asking our enemies to fix it, so that there's no more cops who will do that. So what do? They tell you that, oh, we're going to have sensitivity trainings for these cops, you know. Or we're going to have more Black and Latino cops on the force. And those of us who are the more revolutionaries, we're saying, especially the anarchists, we're saying, fuck that. We don't need cops. We don't need government. We don't need just sensitivity programs. We need you out of our communities. We need you out. But people in the communities need to get in their minds that we need our lives. We don't need to rely on anybody in them positions when they have historically just jerked you around. Generation after generation, why are we still waiting for them to come up with some plan that they've made so big that we automatically think that it's too huge for us to be able to resolve on our own? So we need the experts who can make these really fantastic analyses and these really intricate programs that's going to solve this problem. I think that's a part of how they just get us out of thinking that we can look at each other and figure this. Because I didn't read some stuff from radical papers where regular folks is making some great analysis on what's going on. Why can't we trust that we can figure this? You know, we still, somebody somewhere up top is the only ones capable of figuring this out. You know?
And they have huge power of the state behind them, which they won't hesitate to use. I mean, I think that's evident in the scenario that you're outlining. And, I mean, we'd all be in tune with that. But at the end of the day, we all need to share the pain and all this shite. They're going to go down with that, and they're going to have the cops to enforce it. And the repression will be vicious when they break into Little's. I know what you're talking about.
They're already training. There's special training going on now within the guards for this upcoming
arrest.
In the United States too. They're already training.
Because I was talking to a guard on Saturday, and somebody said that his kid was training in the couple with my young fella. Special squads for riots.
Where's it going on? Or
I didn't spell too much into what's going on, but it's happened.
They're talking in the United States about, I guess they want to put extra security around the banks, because they think people might start robbing banks.
But it didn't happen.
You want to go inside, first of all.
It didn't happen in 29 to 32.
The
war breakdown. But it was amazing, I was watching a program about that. In 1929, the reason America collapsed was greed and capitalism. But the same people that was involved in that, the same companies
are involved today in America with the collapse of the economy. Oh, yeah. Agreed. The same names,
right,
of people.
Yeah. Right.
And the president that took over at the time had a Senate committee jail some of them. Actually, yeah. But you know who was looking after them? Who was the investigator was Al Kennedy. It was like the president was like the fox.
Oh, yeah.
Watching the hen house because he was the worst. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He made an absolute fortune on the collapse of Wall Street. Yeah. And that's where he made all his money.
I'm getting emails all the time from a website which is, says it's Main Street in America. And not the Wall Street, saying exactly how you make money in the current circumstances. I mean, you can make huge money on the fall of shares.
Yeah. Well, what did your man say? Warren Buffett. Said. What did he say? He says, you don't make money when times are good.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
And he's the richest man in the world.
Joe? And yeah. Something to contribute here, you know.
Well, I don't make money at all. So
he has made money.
He's the richest man in Ireland.
That's pretty simple.
Yeah. But
what? That's my hand.
Yeah, there you go.
Here's to all of you.
Jeez, you got out of that. Trying to put you on the spot.
An interesting since I've been here. Some of the stuff I think I knew. It's like, you know, the history of the Irish in the United States. I guess I needed to be reminded that the British brought a lot of Irish to the United States as slaves.
Yeah.
For us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I must have forgot that. And then the one book that I had on Irish slang, right? And then you come to find out all these words that I thought was black language.
Yeah.
It's actually Irish. You dig and dig and a whole bunch of jazz and all this other stuff. But last year we wanted to do this political prisoner march. And we did the march, but I had one of my ideas was doing it from Central Park. Because there's an area in Central Park that used to be an Irish and African community.
Yeah.
And what got rid of it was the guy who had the idea of creating Central Park. They uprooted the community, you know. But it was like one of them examples where we lived together, we fought together, we intermarried, and all this stuff. But then when the United States, with the racism, comes in, you know, to exclude and divide people, they use the white supremacy thing, you know. You got white skin, you're better than them other people, you know. And eventually got a lot of Irish to buy into it. Same thing with the Italians and others. But there's so much history where we fought together, you know. So it's like, well, man, people need to know that stuff, you know. So I wanted the march to start from there as a way of, because Irish Americans in New York are just terrible.
Yeah.
They're terrible, you know. But people still need to know, like, there was times where we fought, you know, together.
Yeah. And certainly that was true
of their history.
Yeah.
That was true.
You
are a New Yorker, are you?
Mm-hmm. Even though born and raised in New Jersey, I've been in New Jersey 20-something years now. And I guess New Jersey is like the metro area of New York anyhow. Yeah.
But that was true at the time of the H Block.
Eh?
You know, there were a lot of cops on the side of the H Block, and at the same time, you knew that they were out and out racist.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, all New York cops were racist. Well, apart from all the white New York cops were racist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we welcomed them to our cops because they came to
a lot of things we had to do was very difficult.
But when Bernadette Devlin came, man, that was big news. Bernadette Devlin came to the United States and she gave support to the Black Panther Party. That was like...
And Castro stayed in an hotel in Harlem.
In Harlem.
Yeah.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's like we always knew that like the Irish Republican Movement supported our struggles.
Yes.
You know? And I know that some Panthers who went off to training camps somewhere in one of the Arab lands, there was Irish, Japanese, everybody was getting all this guerrilla warfare training. But it was just like the 60s and 70s was still that time where it seemed like all of our struggles was going to bring down whatever our imperialisms were. It's like we were going to bring them down.
And I think that's what made the 60s and 70s so good for me. You know, so that's what sticks with me. We can do it again. It's much more difficult now, but we gotta figure it.
That spirit that led me to come to Ireland, you know.
Yeah.
But maybe you're. I was thinking that this is late 1929. Mm. You're at a time when there's huge changes. Now, what will be in 3 years or 5 years, we don't know. They could be, as you were saying, even frightening changes. But there's no doubt they're going to be big. And what's going to come out of it is, I know we mightn't be able to to influence it completely, but we should try and have some influence on it.
Mm-hmm.
On the direction of it, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If only the rightness of armed struggle that comes out of the six counties, and that's what Republicans carry on their shoulders,
mm-hmm.
that it's right to attack them,
mm-hmm.
or to get your own back,
mm-hmm.
it's right to challenge them in arms,
mm-hmm.
and I mean that is in a sense, like what happened on Saturday was inevitable. I mean it was going to happen one day, or you said that exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's going to do a lot to make it harder for Sinn Féin to say, yes, that's what we have to be prepared to do. That's what ultimately is only going to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes things very much harder for us, or for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think necessarily, I don't know, I don't get the perception, having been in other countries, you don't get a big, that you're fighting back. I don't think, there's not this big kind of pacifist trend in Irish politics at all, that you do get in other countries, which is deeply problematic, because it means that if a cop hits you, you're disposed to go on again, and somehow this can change things. But I don't think that is a problem in this country. Maybe I'm too idealistic and hoping that people will, but I think in this country there is a potential for a positive outcome. Through all this, it's going to be very difficult. People are going to go through a lot, but I think the left can definitely point people in the right direction. The sense that it's not like immigrants, they're not the ones who created this. It's the rich. Go after the rich, must pay, the rich must pay, the rich must pay, and that must be the message. And I think we're definitely big enough to do that. Whether we can shape the overall outcome, and not necessarily maybe it's positive that other people with new ideas who haven't, learned or been shaped by mistakes up till now, because obviously everyone has made mistakes right now because we're in this situation. But I think the left can definitely point the direction of. It's banks, rich people, politicians, they created this, you didn't fight it, they did. I think that is possible, definitely.
Well, the opinion polls for the first time ever are showing a possible alternative government here at the left. What left?
I mean,
the SWP, the Trotskyist left,
which I don't really have any time for, they're calling for nationalisation of the banks. I mean, they're that crazy. And I mean, you wanted to judge on the experience of Rossport, which I know you've been heavily involved in, and so it's certainly Jim has, and myself as well. I mean, Rossport shows you exactly the calibre of the people that you're trying to organise with. You know, there's a hardcore, a brilliant community in Rossport, and they've kept the struggle going, and it's not gone yet. But at the same time, the mass of the people were all bought off by Shell.
That's true.
I don't mean to put the people of Ireland down, that would be daft. But at the same time, what we have to hold to is the tradition that the IRA has led over this last century. And the tragedy is that that IRA tradition doesn't come with the ideology of challenging imperialism. It comes with the ideology of getting the Brits out of our country. But it only goes so far. And it's infinitely, I mean, that's what we've been saying before, it's infinitely easy for the imperialists to grab it and turn it to their advantage, like you're saying Obama is likely to be doing in the States. I mean, that's the conflict that we're in.
I think one thing that is important in this country, though, is that there is a tendency, like we're talking about, with due respect, with the legacy of the IRA and stuff, there is a tendency in that towards authoritarianism, and definitely at times unhelpful authoritarianism, and I think that has to be challenged at the same time because.
But I mean, it's really difficult if you're not starting from an ideological position. I mean, you should talk to us about what the experience of the Black Panthers. I'm quite sure that they also had those problems. I think they're inevitably associated with an armed struggle,
mm-hmm.
which the Black Panthers were heavily involved in.
Yeah.
And I mean, how do you build a political organisation out of that? and yet you need the armed struggle to make them realise, to shake in their boots, to make them realise that then they can't beat you militarily.
Yeah.
But the political struggle has to be built if you want to win.
Yeah.
And it seems to me a successful military struggle, which I do believe the IRA have fought in this country, it's not easy to shed the old methods of organisation and the kind of things that Jim was talking about, the secrecy of the organisation, the hierarchical nature of it, and so on and so forth. I mean, we've all seen the reason for that and the need for it. I mean, but it doesn't take you a way forward to get out of those habits.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you go about organising your communities now?
Oh, it just doesn't happen in a real sense. Who's organizing the community now is people like George Soros' money, you know, and these foundations. The people want to organize. He has, a lot of times young people or women want to do different organizing, and they don't raise the monies from the communities. They go to foundations, right? And you got to fill out all this paperwork. You got to draw out a whole plan about what it is you want to do, who's your constituency, and you submit it, and they may give you monies. Right, it's not like real grassroots organizing, like what we were doing, you know. So like, they're your money source. You know, you can't be radical. You can't even use radical language. You don't even hear the word revolution anymore. You hear people talk about social justice, you know, and all other kind of language that is just, it's not there.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like when I go around and speak, you know, I'm telling people about what we did in the Panther Party. You know, what was great about it is that we went into communities, and people in the community, because they related to your what you were trying to do, they supported you. Free breakfast program. Simple, great idea. You know, or going around or cop, what they call cop watch now, watching the police, you know.
With the guns.
Yeah. Well,
when you take them off,
places where you could carry it legally.
Yeah.
But where I come from on the East Coast, we couldn't carry guns legally.
But in California, that's exactly what they did. Yeah.
But because we couldn't carry them legally, it didn't mean we didn't carry them. Right? Yeah. But we couldn't. But we could stand and watch them. We knew the legal distance. We knew the laws and everything. But people could relate to that, and they would be coming in to support you. You know, the Black Liberation Army was supposed to protect them programs and protect the community. But then here comes the split, you know. Huey Newton and them want to go more into politics, the mainstream stuff, and play down the gun. Those of us wanted to like maintain the program, but we wanted to still build the underground to protect the program, the communities. But there was no internal democracy. Whatever Huey and them said, that's what it was. And until it got to the split, you know. And I mean, people got killed in the split, but it never got to like here. That's why I'm saying, well, what would have happened if we had survived? We might have gotten to the same stuff we had about five different Black Liberation Armies, five different Black Panther Parties, or groups that want this ideological leadership fighting, you know, while the system figures out a way to play on all that and continually divide us from the community. Because when we got isolated from the community, they just picked us off. Easy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we haven't recovered from that. So it's been like over 30 years. We have not recovered from that yet.
Drugs played a big part in destroying the
such
black
a big,
community.
Such a big part.
And it wouldn't have been so much in the 60s to come after that.
It was there. I mean, drugs has been around for a long time, but in the massive levels, like you're talking about the end of the 60s going into the 70s, the communities started getting flooded.
Yeah,
with drugs and
guns.
Everywhere.
Yeah, and it did a lot to this day.
Yeah.
You talk about a drug economy, and the role that the gangs play is like they keep a level of fear going.
And they're the role models for the kids.
For the kids.
The drug dealers.
50 Cent, Jay-Z, you know, Tupac, Biggie, you know, and these kids are dangerous. So like when I, like that's one reason I went to Belfast, I wanted to meet folks who were doing the Citizens Against Drugs, and then on the Feminist Walking Tour, the one place we stopped with the hand, Dwayne.
Just off that, Recherche during their research recruits process near Charlotte Harris Street.
One woman there from that who used to the work that they did against drugs. Because if we can't figure out a way to deal with drugs in the United States, I don't think we'll ever be able to really root ourselves in communities. Because them drug dealers and kids and adults who pushing their buttons, they will not allow us to just settle in and begin to like have programs that pull people away from them.
Oh, we have the same problem exactly in Limerick. I mean, that's probably the height of it. I mean, it's creeping everywhere else. It's definitely creeping where I live in Dublin. I mean, you can see it coming.
Well, you'll be afraid where they take on any organisation.
They make organisation, Raleigh, you believe impossible, because they have the whole middle class, the solicitors, the lawyers, and the rich bankers that clean their money and all that stuff. The whole community gets involved and they terrorise anyone who wants to see set up. But, I mean, you know much more about it than I do.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen the movie. Y'all seen the movie on the Panthers? It's not a documentary, it's a movie. The movie is good, but towards the end of the movie, there's a, and I don't know if they base this off of anything they really know, but I believe it's probably true. The FBI can't figure out how to stop the spread of the Black Panther Party. So they have this secret meeting with the mafia, and they make a deal with the mafia.
Flood
the areas. Yeah. And the mafia is like, okay, but y'all gotta like leave us alone.
Yeah.
You know? So then the deal is made. You know? And the reason I believe it's true because it seems like that's exactly what happened.
Well, a very interesting thing on that was in yesterday's paper, I think it was, it said about the huge increase there is in cocaine production in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just coinciding with the recession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you say, well, why is there a huge increase? You'd think in a recession a decrease because people have less money, less spare cash.
Mm-hmm. And there's all kind of evidence at this point where government, military, planes, everything was bringing drugs in from Latin America to the United States. And the key people were gangs.
Yeah.
You know, Contras and all of the financing, the Contras to drugs in our community.
I mean, you know, that company, Danco, had permission to fly flights back into the States from Colombia. They couldn't be searched or anything. And I mean, that was just one particular example of the way they used got the drugs out of Colombia into America.
Right. And I mean, that's why for me it's like, I just feel like there has to be an underground. But with all the stuff that has happened, how do you keep that under control or keep it in check so that it doesn't at some point overwhelm what our objectives are, our vision for the type of society we want? You know, because it could have easily happened in the United States with our movements too. People, I think that some of us really did glorify the gun, you know.
But we have a situation here where there's drug crime, and what Rose had referred to there in Limerick, where they absolutely destroyed, they had to demolish a large part of the city to rebuild it, hoping that'll cure the problem, which it won't. No. But what you had, the situation was, with somebody pushing cocaine or heroin or whatever, and if they'd say, oh, your man's pushing, you have it on him now, you know, go and arrest him. They say, I've got word, leave him alone. He's working for us. Please. There's another one, I'll leave him alone. He's working for us. And it works out. All the drug pushers are working for the police. Each one's informing on the other, round in circles. And the drug problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But all of them have immunity, as it were, on the basis that by supplying information. And we've got this very, very curious relationship between drugs and the police. And it went to the stage that it was last week or so on the telly,
Prime Time.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they brought out about at the very top level of the police. How this a heroin pusher who had been caught red-handed and then caught again while out in bail, and he stood free. and obviously been protected at the highest levels by that, by people in the place.
Mm-hmm.
And so we turn around and say, why do we have a drug problem?
Mm.
And you say, well, the police are at least a factor in the drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
The town I come from, Castlecomer in Norfolk County, small town, it's like 3,000 people. A girl who I went to school with just got sent down, she was a junkie.
Yeah.
This is in a town of 4,000 people. Everyone in the town, the guy's name is Pat Dreeland, everybody knows him. Police go up there once every 6 months, pull the place apart, find nothing. He goes around, he threatens the police in the town, but I just think it's just, it's a lack of care, because it's like, who's buying the drugs, who's using them, who's lying to them, who's going to prison for them.
Yeah.
It's what are regarded as inconsequential people. So they're never going to send, like, you know, the ERU down with, like, back up at a cabin, like, just get the guy. That's not going to happen, because it's just, it doesn't really come onto the radar that much. It's like, you know, a couple of people die, or, you know, that guy terrorised the town. Two guys I was in school with since I left school committed suicide because they owed him money.
Mm.
Like, now that's, you know, an escalated problem, obviously, within them, but, and no one gives, like, it's not a real care, like, he's wrecked the town, but no one is really willing to put it up, like, from a stage point of view.
Do you have answers in the States as to how you go about organising, looking forward to what's going to happen and the potential of it? Do you see ways to organise the underground and the overground?
Yeah, I mean, I still think both has to happen. The United States ain't seen an underground since the 70s, but it's like, but primary should always be the above ground. Primary should always be organizing our communities. It should be like getting people to understand why self-determination should be implemented from our communities to the workplaces, to the streets, to whatever institution affects our lives. We should be about taking them over, reorganizing them in whatever way, and our attitude has to be there without compromise. I just think when we get to compromising is when our enemies, so skilled in what they do, they take it and use it to their advantage. And we good-hearted, we're like, okay, we're going to trust this process. They're going to be fair. They cut our throats, and we're upset. I'm like, shouldn't be upset. I mean, they've been doing this for 100 years, or hundreds of years now. They, you know. And nobody wants to suffer. I mean, you know, but we haven't figured out a way to kind of turn it. You know.
So few can manipulate so many.
Yeah.
Somebody.
Yeah. Especially when they have a lot of money to work with.
A lot of money, and they have they own the media, they own the. Crazy.
Yeah.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, Joe.
You can have my seat then, go.
Yeah. Is it with someone's head?
No, I got a phone call. I have to pick up the info.
Have you all read the book, Trinity by Leon Uris? That was the book that I read in prison.
It's one of my favorite books.
That first one taught me about Ireland. Even though I know that I didn't heard people since I've been here saying, well, that's okay, but it was just the first one that really opened me up to
historical novel.
When I learned that the 800 years thing. Because in the United States, we black people, we'll say in a minute, we've been oppressed for 400 years, almost like it's a badge, right? And then like 800 is twice as long as we've been oppressed by the basically the same people.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And in the book, you realize that the ups and downs of the Irish movement, we all got these ups and downs. So I felt a little bit better, because it seemed like the black movement always, we fight, we fail. We fight. But then it's like, okay, the Irish been doing this twice as long as we have. They ain't stopped yet. So I guess we can do this. You know.
Yeah. Nice meeting you. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. See you later.
Yeah.
Please go.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a jack seat? Does it, does,
sorry?
Just use the jack.
It's the failing bit that's the we have to get away around that.
There's another factor too. Only about, you can correct me if I'm wrong here,
but 11-12% of people on the ground are political animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, every 5 years or whatever, they go and they vote, but they're not really... They need more of a political education.
Yeah, in some way have been involved.
Aye, absolutely. That's how it is here, anyway. You know, it's just... they vote, but they don't even... A relatively small percentage. I mean, more, you know, it's not an important thing in there.
Yeah.
In there, really.
A factor we have here, what Joe's saying, is the middle class turn out much more in elections.
Oh, yeah.
The working class areas, and particularly the more deprived, the voter turnout is quite low. Very low.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that elected institutions, like even though the government, are much more influenced by the better off in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to motivate people in a badly off area to come out and vote in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not feel there's any point?
Yeah.
Because they're being overlooked anyway.
That's right.
So they say, well, we should revolve, we're going to get overlooked anyway. They'll be
But that's one of the things with the Obama thing is that you had, because basically the same thing in the United States, working class folks, poor folks don't tend to vote. But in the black community, with Obama running, you had criminals and everybody was like, I'm registering, I'm voting.
Yeah.
Because of the symbolic thing, you know.
Of course,
like,
that's understandable.
You know? So, I mean, the other thing that might happen with it is that there's going to be a lot more activism again coming out of the black community. So it may go beyond Obama, you know, especially like when the honeymoon is over.
Good.
You know, yeah, it may go beyond him.
Yeah.
We'd be dissimilar there because we don't have our president that doesn't own the country.
Mm.
So presidency over here is just a gimmick.
But they don't in the United States either.
Yeah.
But symbolically, that's
symbolically
what people believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, even for us to say that, like when Obama was running, you know, some of us would be the critical voices, and people were like thinking that you just raining on their parade, you know, you just don't want to see this happen. And we're like, come on, he's a politician, and don't no president really run the country, you know. And I mean, from all of that, you'd be like, well, do you know his program? Do you know? And no, but he's a black man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Yeah.
So I just thought it was important.
No,
we're
getting the book.
Yeah, I just thought it was important that some of us have to be the critical voices. We got to at least say it.
Yes.
You know, instead of just like a lot of the movement people were all on the Obama bandwagon. And for a lot of us, we're like, yo, I don't know how you're doing this, but we're not going to do that.
Well, you see, they're just not really, like here, they're not really political animals. They're not.
Mm.
If they have a job, they're happy enough and so on. You know?
Well, what about Condoleezza Rice? She was the exception to that rule.
She's a rare.
She was really.
And don't nobody like her.
No. No. Nobody goes anywhere.
Yeah.
You know,
where did she come from?
She was a real Mormon.
Yeah, really.
She was worse than Bush. She came across as being more aggressive.
Yeah.
You can always find them. They're always somewhere.
You can always find them. But when I think back on them too, like, her and Colin Powell kind of prepared the way for Obama, because you never had any black people in them high positions, visible high positions before, you know. But yeah, she was a piece of work, man.
Is that
she was.
She was the U.S. ambassador down in the United Nations.
Wait a minute.
Because she's got the same last name. I wouldn't if she was
a sister. I hope not. But you can believe that Obama's putting people in office, and it seems like they all are Clinton people.
Yeah, exactly.
So even though he wins over Miss Hillary,
they still win.
So maybe Hillary's really won. But that's we got a situation in the United States to deal with too. It's a crazy situation.
It's new ground.
It is new ground.
Well,
it is.
Yeah. Very hard to anticipate, you know, in the future.
Yeah.
He said,
So this year and next year should be some interesting years.
Well, of course it will. When did you come over here?
On the 24th.
McMurray's thing.
All right. I hit back tomorrow.
Ah, yeah.
Not enough time. Not enough time.
Well, you can always come back again.
I'm coming. I'm trying to work my way now into a conference that's supposed to be happening next year. She's trying to work my way into that. Yeah. Yeah, but it's been good. Yeah. I mean, it's like in prison you get National Geographic. So I had National Geographic. I had, my lawyer had got me a subscription to Sinn Féin's newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, all of this from the 70s, you know. So, like, one day I'm coming here. I just didn't think it would happen until the anarchists got me here for the book fair.
Fair play. You know. So you're a National Geographic fan, are you?
Yeah. And it's funny too because I watched the movies and everything. I watched the Irish movies, the Michael Collins, In the Name of the Father, the Barley one.
The Wind that Shakes the Barley. You're pretty well versed.
So I'm on the plane.
Oh, I know.
Michael Collins is not historically correct.
Oh, I heard. I didn't heard it already. And the woman on the tour of the jail today, she made that plain too.
Is that right?
Yeah, she said it's not necessarily historically accurate.
Petroleum, you know.
But everybody on the plane looked like Irish to me. It looked like right from the movies. I'm like, oh my God, I'm really going to Ireland.
Then of artistic license.
I don't think it was open numbers in the 20s, was it?
So it's been good. Cork was great. Galway was great. Belfast was great.
Where were we in Galway?
Oh, man.
Richardson's, was it? The pub in the corner, was it?
Oh, Galway City?
In Galway?
Yeah.
Man, I know we went to a pub. It's like we always had to go to a pub.
Well, that's a must.
Oh, that's a nice tradition.
I don't remember. But I know the one in Belfast, they said it was the oldest.
Kelly Sellers, wasn't it?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah. We went there.
Well, you got a lot of information. You're well.
couldn't hang with the Guinness, though.
Don't like it.
No.
Well, come back. All I can say is come back again.
When are you leaving?
It's got to be.
You've got to drink loads and loads of it.
Before. You didn't get a bag of Terry. So that's what Terry's one of those.
I would always. Certainly.
There's a pub there where the film was made, Michael Collins. But it's the actual pub Michael Collins used.
Where is this?
It's down by the station there, about 5 minutes from here. Like,
So it doesn't...
There's a lot of New Yorkers in there a couple of weeks ago, haven't we, there?
Yeah,
that's right.
The Grattan Law Society.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Your man gave them a tour. It was a very old pub, like.
Yeah.
But very interesting.
I went to James Connolly's house. That we stopped it out at in Belfast.
And Glen Road, though.
Yeah.
Sinn Féin, obviously.
Yeah.
Would have been.
And then to the cemetery.
Mill
Hill.
Well, you did a good tour, all right, then.
I had a good tour. It's just like
busy,
more time.
You had a busy
stay
once you were here.
Yeah.
You were pretty busy.
Yeah. Joe Doherty was, I had to meet him.
Yeah.
I didn't do time in the same place as he was at, but he did time with some of my other comrades.
Yeah.
So I let them know I was coming. So, of course, it's like, find him, give him our greetings.
Yeah.
You know, so I did. It was really good.
You met him.
You
met Joe, did you?
Huh?
You met him?
Met him, yeah. Yeah. And he didn't, it seemed like he does some great work.
He does, yes, definitely.
I just wish we had like in the United States, like when you walk down that road, falls. We don't have anything like that. We don't have anything in the States that tells us our history of struggle.
No, I know what you mean.
You know, just nothing. The cemetery itself.
That cemetery, when you go there, and I've been there many times. It's such a cold place. There's a wind blowing.
Yeah.
You ever notice that?
Yeah, all cemeteries are like
that. Well, that one in particular.
Yeah. You don't want to get blood.
I can give you. This is a story a Colombian gorilla wrote from the ALN. And it's an interesting why he became a gorilla.
Mm-hmm.
And from his eyes as a you know, like a person there.
Yeah.
In his own words.
You know. Okay. Right on. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you and him were
Johnny
we were in the same.
Where's he at now?
Sorry, he's still there.
Oh, oh really?
He's doing 40.
And can you imagine jail without any hands?
Wow, that's
an American mind in jail.
he lost both his hands in the grenade.
Oh man, there's a comrade.
And he wrote it like this.
Really?
Yeah. And they bonded on him, and he came under Jim's friendship. He came back and he rewrote it again, and Jim smuggled it out and sent it back here.
Okay. There's a comrade in Cuba now, Puerto Rican, from the Puerto Rican underground. But when he had escaped out of this jail in New York, he didn't have any hands because he was a bomb guy. He was a guy that put, but one of them bombs went off a little prematurely. So just it was amazing that he still was able to do a rope ladder and get out of this jail, and then eventually made his way to Cuba. He's been in Cuba now for like 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what it reminds me of. It's like, it doesn't matter, you know. It's like, we are really amazing people when it comes down to it, under the worst conditions, you know. There's comrades have been in prison for 30 years. Some I go to visit, and they're still so optimistic.
Yeah.
I go in there depressed, and I come out of there, I'm like, ready to go.
See,
it's one never of the things you have to be optimistic, otherwise you should have Jerry. Jerry.
The American Jerry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How's
a girl from New York? You probably have another Jerry from New York.
Oh,
she's from New York, isn't she?
She's on the Leonard
campaign
over there.
Really?
He said
we yeah, we definitely work with that, yeah.
Yeah.
I think she's New York, is she?
He's not doing good in terms of health, but always a lot of work around
him. Well, you're very lucky then.
I know.
Jerry normally does the talking.
She does the talking. That's not yet from
Jerry.
Yeah, she's from, I think New York she's from.
Really?
Yeah.
I got to find out.
Yeah, she's here now, only for years now, isn't she?
Living here?
She's only here more than 2 years.
What is she?
I met her the day she landed here.
She's getting her citizenship this week.
I was there today, she met a whole people.
Oh.
Okay. In where we were yesterday, we actually met.
Did
they? Yeah. She was always part of that campaign, the Leather Peltier campaign.
Yeah.
Mm. She used to send T-shirts off at Fort Leash and that.
She was over with the other fella who was released.
Yeah.
He was one of the Native Americans.
Yeah.
Who had been in with them.
With Leonard.
But was released, mm-hmm. Whereas Leonard is still there.
Right.
And he came here and he was given a bit of a talk about what he was about. And
you remember his name?
God, I can't
remember. No. Bob Rabadou?
Yes.
No,
one is Bob
Rabadou. Okay, though.
He's actually related to Leonard. He was one that was released.
I'm okay.
If it's him, he just died.
I'm here now. Where are you?
Not even a month. In Spain.
Okay, right, yeah.
It was just 5 minutes
think it's Bob Robert. I think he had a fall. I think he fell down the stairs and hit his head or something.
Oh, I think so.
But his case is, if anybody know any political prisoner cases, is either Leonard Peltier or it's Mumia Abu Jamal.
Is he coming up again for an appeal or something?
It's always
6 months or so.
The last court hearing he had, it wasn't a good decision. I think he has maybe one more.
Yes,
you know,
that's right.
And it's like trying to keep people informed that he can still be executed.
Yes.
You know.
Right.
So, you know, a couple of years ago he had a favorable decision that seemed like to many people was the victory.
Yes.
So everybody relaxed and like... Yes. The movement around him kind of died down, so we're trying to build it back up.
Yes.
Yeah. But building a political prisoner movement in the United States is hard. Really hard.
Hard already, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And that's my main work right now.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Trying to figure out, which is another reason coming here, right? I wanted, like, in the 70s, it was like the nationalist communities and others knew who the political prisoners were.
Yeah.
How was it done? What were people doing?
Yeah.
You know, For the United States, I mean, people seem to be satisfied with just having marches, demos, forums, but don't go into the communities.
Yeah.
Which is
it was the women that did it in Oslo. To my mind, there's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry Peter isn't here anymore to contest, but it was women who, back in, what was it, 79, they were standing on the back of lorries in the pouring talk, yeah. in the pouring rain with the blankets, and they managed to move the men by the Republican struggle becoming part of the kitchen table, that people began talking about mm-hmm. something they'd never talked about before,
yeah.
not in the kitchen table.
Right.
And I mean, it grew like that. So, but it was in the early days when they were on the dirty mm-hmm. process and all that, it was very, very hard times.
Right.
But there had been a bit of a tradition always of political prisoners here. You know, that True. Was, you're talking about in the hunger, the early lead up
yeah.
to the hunger
yeah.
strikes.
Yeah.
Right. Certainly the women.
Blanket and all that stuff.
Right, the blanket man.
Yeah, it was ghastly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, these mothers, they went to see their sons and there wasn't anyone campaigning outside.
Mm-hmm.
You simply couldn't get the people down here particularly involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from Mirahawk. But mm-hmm. what did that thing then in that Meath, then
yeah.
in Avon? Now, what they do at all these gatherings is some object, now it was a barrel on, you know, like a drum that was made by a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And it was raffled.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an arm, sometimes it would be a little harp, sometimes it would be. But all the time when people are meeting, there's little raffles, there's little things like this.
That was made for the last batch of prisoners, for provisional prisoners
yeah.
from Parlish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, not again, sorry. That's the last
yeah.
of the provisional prisoners.
One doesn't like that word.
Castlery, Parlish.
One doesn't like that word provisional. I don't like it either. I don't know why he uses it, but they still use it.
I know that
yourself.
Mm-hmm. In 2005.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one day, man, we'll have something that says 2009, all our political prisoners released 2010.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you see the sort of thing that goes through, it's constantly reminding people of prisoners.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you have. You're selling the tickets and you're putting the thing and then they're meeting for the, you know, like they're having the raffle and then there's another, and which prisoner is this and which,
mm-hmm.
I don't know now in that one, but in a lot of them,
that's the, that's
what
they
do is they sign the names, the prisoners oh. sign the names around it.
Mm-hmm.
See, and then people will be saying, oh, I remember him.
Oh, yeah,
I remember
yeah.
him. You know, I, and then they that tell the story of each of them.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, there's literally thousands and thousands of things like that. So they're hanging in houses all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And and when I was in Colombia, we had to think of making harps. Is that sort of thing the Celtic cross now?
Mm-hmm.
Making a little harp. And I found the Colombians were also making harps. A totally different.
But they also made the bracelets.
But there, yeah, the Colombian yeah. prisoners also make things.
That's
okay.
Oh, geez, thanks
very much. I'm sorry, I
forgot. This one here was made by Republicans, Che Guevara.
I love this. Yeah,
Ernesto
yeah.
Che Guevara Lynch. He was an Irish grandparent, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of a 1916 IRA volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all maybe Republicans, that sort of thing, you know.
But these wee bracelets, I'm sure that that's possible. Is that possible for people on death row to make stuff?
They can make stuff. The political prisoners, they, some of the, like one of the things that comes out a lot is they do artwork. But we got to really get it into communities, man. We just people in the communities need to see it, not. Places that are kind of artsy
yeah.
that we
yeah.
may be able to get. I mean, it's got to be done in the community.
See, these were a source of finance as well. Like, we bring that gold on a given Sunday and we raffle it.
Mm-hmm.
And that money you go straight back to the prison
mm-hmm.
for,
mm-hmm.
you know, cheap bits and pieces,
right.
even smoke and
buy more materials to make more.
More material to make more, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it was like an industry, a cottage industry at one stage, you know.
Joe done every jail in England. He spent time in every one of them there, like, didn't he? And in long cash.
Nice guy, right?
Mine was federal, so if you get convicted of federal.
Ah, yes. I know what you mean.
That was my tour of the United States. They were so nice. You know.
They just keep moving. And
they kept moving.
You don't get any forward notice or anything.
What did they call that? Ghosting, wasn't it?
Ghosting, yeah.
Just to fuck your family up really for visits and things
like that.
The year when I was here, you know.
And Jim left prison without permission. He blew himself out.
Gordon.
You didn't ask permission, did you?
There was a book in prison that I got. I mean, and it was hard to get revolutionary material in. But besides the Leon Uris book, there was, and I haven't been able to find out what it. I don't remember the title, but it was
Trinity.
No, not Trinity, but there was another one that was just on IRA escapes, prison escapes. It was just
they wouldn't
on that.
Let you have it. I'm sure they wouldn't.
Well, I had it. I mean, it's, I don't know how it even got into the prison, but it may have been somehow somebody.
Sorry, book out of prison.
I'm up here. Because one of the things about the Black Liberation Army is that we definitely tried in every way we could to get out of them prisons. We was not like trying to sit around and do these times. I never made it, but others did. Yeah. But I definitely was part of crews that tried. We tried. Yeah. You know, so it's like, you know, your inspiration came from many places. So, it's like people just, I tell young people today that you got to take risks. You cannot just stay comfortable. You can't stay in the box. No. You know, you got to be a little crazy. Yeah. You know, so.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
Raise them
the easy.
Well,
a lot of people a little crazy.
I gotta get my camera. I'm gonna take a picture.
Put it up against there where you have the light.
Hold it for there or something.
Put it.
Will we all get close to each other?
Well, do you want to all stand around it?
Do you want all of us?
Oh, that'd be good. Yeah, I mean, if people don't mind.
No.
I would love to take a picture.
I'm answering back for you.
Just I'll let you see your cousins.
You have a little hanger on it.
You stay where you are. We get around you. Sorry, I'll get down here.
Stick that across your knee.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Cool.
And I want to get right beside you.
You go in there.
Smoke. Good. Yeah,
exactly. I don't know how to do all that other stuff, man.
I'm still learning the. I'm still learning the technology, man. It intimidates me.
Can you want to be in the picture?
Check one of them?
What do you want?
Sure.
Do you want to sit in and want
to That's what I'm going to sit
in. Why are you actually going to
sit in? I'll sit in here. I'll be right.
Sure. You sit in on the picture. So
hold on.
You're getting clipped.
Yeah.
Get on your knee.
Okay, ready?
I tell you what, it has to be experienced. It couldn't be described.
Good? Nice bowl.
That looks good.
Nice to be nice in the bowl.
It only stays for a second.
Oh, yeah.
Very.
Do I have to move it forward from that?
I think you're just repressing that again. I should just. Oh, wait a minute.
But you should be able to see it now, right?
Yeah. No, I'm not. What I'm seeing is the last page.
You need to change it around.
It says press the button again that brings up the.
So
oh.
You're the expert.
Oh, I'm going to press it again. That's it. Do so.
No.
Sorry,
I'm on the. We're getting too much light on the bar on.
Leo,
too much
light.
No, I'm alright. No,
hold on. It's probably better if I stand in front of the window so shades from the light.
Do you know how to operate
it? Somebody who stands where?
Do what?
If I know if I just stand here, you'll just shit, block out the light a bit.
Yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
So then we're
going to be in the
picture. No, no.
The problem I'm having is that's grand.
At some point we gotta discipline the young people because
they
be out of control, you know?
Yeah. But they have all the technology
that
they think
about. They do. And they hold it over.
I think we got the coverage in it.
How does that work?
And you're in it, of course. It's just that it's showing me.
That's very colourful jumper.
The man in the colourful jumper.
Leo the lion. Yeah, that would be good. All right.
Thank you. Leo, thanks very, very much.
No problem. That's me, Father's Magazine for Against the English for Wars Independence in 1920. That's in here. I'm presented with a medal from the President of Ireland. And that's that. Bogota, Ramadero.
Shit.
You're back.
Yeah.
Okay. The medal's in the figure.
Yeah. That's a Galician horn or the back of it there. Galicia.
Really?
Yeah. There's a big connection between Galicia and Northern Spain and the Irish. Very similar.
Who's in the picture?
Oh, that's my mother and her brothers and sisters in 1912. I was taken on in Belfast on the Titanic ship before it left Belfast shipyard.
Even however cold it is.
My father's uncle worked on the building of it. And they were allowed to take their families on board before they left Belfast shipyard. So they had the family all together and took a photograph.
Can you think of it?
Before they left the shipyard.
You'd be good.
Long time ago.
What's Saturday?
Museum, and up here, Total Rebellion, since 1916.
We got all that with the German myself.
I'm so happy about this technology, man.
Now
they're going to have to show me how you upload it to the upload or download to the computer.
It's usually a little cable. But once they show.
Oh shit.
Isn't it
from my house? I remember.